Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Mark Barone to the show, all the way from Sao Paulo in Brazil. Mark's PhD is in human physiology, and he has two postgraduate diplomas, diabetes education and communication, and more than 20 years of experience in public and global health, education, and patient advocacy. He's vice president of the International Diabetes Federation, founder and general manager of the Intersectoral Forum to Fight Non-Communicable Diseases in Brazil, and he holds many roles in various societies, including being a member of the steering committee of Life for a Child's International Program and serves the education department of the Brazilian Diabetes Society. Dr. Barone, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation, Jonathan.
It's lovely to have you, and lovely that you speak such perfect English, because my Portuguese is non-existent. So, kicking off, Mark, you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and celiac disease at age 10. What inspired you to become an advocate? Some people with who are living with chronic diseases sort of hide them away. Others become a champion. You chose the latter, very brave route. Tell us about your journey.
Yeah, that's correct about my diagnosis when I was 10, Jonathan. And obviously, this is kind of an easy question for me to, you know, kind of to answer without words, but to answer in words, it's harder, because diabetes was always in my life. So even before my diagnosis, because I had many relatives living with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So I remember when I was very young to see, so my grandparents and other family members taking their pills, choosing food carefully, or taking insulin injections. So it was already part of my life before my diagnosis. Obviously, this didn't give me comfort when I received the diagnosis. It was obviously very hard and, you know, a surprise, an unexpected, shocking surprise to be diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. But then after a while, obviously a period of, you know, trying not to accept, I realized that I would live much better and a full life taking insulin injections and, you know, kind of taking care of myself and adjusting to this this routine. And from that time on, I started to pay attention to myself, but also to my family members living with diabetes and assisting them also to live well. And I had the opportunity to connect with a diabetes association, where I still am, the ABJ Diabetes Brazil, the largest diabetes association in Brazil, where I found an environment, you know, that was very positive and encouraging, and where I could see peers living with the same condition, where I could participate in a diabetes camp and feel, you know, kind of stronger and truly develop my independence at that time for living with diabetes. And then I realized that, you know, I could do more, and I could also propose projects, not only participate in projects that were offered to me, but also propose projects and run them. And that's where I started in my career of, you know, initially with diabetes education, and then at that time in parallel also in research, and then moving to other non-communicable diseases and in a more broader angle of public health and global health.
So I'm thinking back to a healthcare conference that I went to a number of years ago, and the keynote speaker was a young lady who was an investment banker who was also diagnosed with diabetes early. And she had basically, she was in investment banking in the diabetes space, and she was informed and she was on top of her disease. And, you know, she had that catchphrase, I have diabetes, but diabetes doesn't have me. And often find that patient advocates who actually know what it's like to live life with the condition can do a huge amount. And we're going to drill down because you've done a lot. Well, let's start with one of your many achievements. You helped secure full health coverage of the cost of diabetes treatment in Brazil. Can you first of all tell us a little bit, those of us who are not familiar with how healthcare is delivered in Brazil, and then tell us about specifically what you achieved with coverage for diabetes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important question. So Brazil is very proud of its universal health coverage system, so which was started in 1988, and but diabetes was not fully covered through this healthcare system. There is a public health care system that is offered for free to all Brazilian citizens, but there was still a lack of treatment for people with diabetes and of availability of medicines and supplies. And that's where we came through the Diabetes Association, ADGA Diabetes Brazil. And in the beginning of the 2000, we started this this important fight in the state of São Paulo to have this covered for one of the most important non-communicable diseases, and to guarantee that people with diabetes in the state at that time would receive not only the medicines and the supplies they need, but also the treatment they need in the entire state. But this was the first only policy that we could get approved, and then it was kind of spread throughout Brazil. Different states also proposed similar policies because obviously this was missing and this was something important for the entire population. And at the end, it became a federal policy to give this full coverage to individuals with diabetes living in Brazil. Obviously, we know that medicine is always evolving and new medicines, new technologies, new ways of treating and educating people with diabetes are developed, and that's why we keep monitoring this and also in contact with the authorities in order to incorporate other important and key medicines or ways of strategies for treating or technologies that would benefit this population in Brazil.
Excellent. So as we look around the world, and I'm going to drill down into this in a little bit further in a minute, we're seeing an explosion of diabetes in the developed countries. And I remember back when I was in medical school, you know, the United States, we were hearing that, wow, 2% of the population have got diabetes. This was astonishing to me. And now, of course, it's 30% have got, you know, diabetes or metabolic syndrome. How do we best tackle the immense financial costs that are going to follow? And how do we prevent it?
Mm-hmm. So obviously, it is very challenging because it is costly to treat diabetes and other non-communicable diseases, especially because they are chronic. So people will live with them their entire life. So you cannot, you know, just give a pill for a period of time and that's it. No, you need to give a pill, to give insulin, to give test strips, to have lab exams during the entire life of that individual. But the thing is, I think, so what most individuals, I mean, authorities and health systems do not consider is that when the individuals with diabetes, they have a good treatment, so they have access to quality of care, and they are in the targets for blood sugar, hemoglobin A1C and also obviously blood pressure and lipids, etc., they have lower risks of developing complications. And this is important because the complications are much more expensive than treating diabetes. So it is important that, you know, the investment is made to actually prevent complications. Obviously, prevent also diabetes, and it is possible. We know that the entire world has been discussing, for example, taxation of sugary drinks, which is one of the ways that we believe that may reduce the prevalence of diabetes, because type 2 diabetes, we know that most of the cases of type 2 diabetes linked with obesity, most of the cases are preventable. And if we offer more healthy food to individuals, if we offer ways to exercise, we can prevent type 2 diabetes.
Well, you know, it's interesting that and why patient education is so important. The perception of diabetes amongst many people is, I've got a bit of sugar in my water, says the, you know, the Northern English patient. Not that I'm going to go blind, my kidneys are going to fail, I'm going to have a stroke, a heart attack, my foot's going to fall off, none of that. And in fact, at a hospital, I will not mention the specific hospital, the dean of the medical school pushed to have the vending machines in the staff cafeteria replace the sugary drinks and the sugary snacks with healthy drinks and healthy snacks. And there was a revolt. These were healthcare workers who were objecting to these sort of changes. So how do we, broadly speaking, how do we get people to buy into this?
I think you're right. And I have seen this in several parts and even in Brazil. So I always mention a case of a school. So schools, unfortunately, in Brazil, private schools, especially, they have their cafeterias full of unhealthy food. And if some of them offer bananas or apples, usually it's hard to find and they are hidden. And the other unhealthy food is very, you know, visible and attractive, etc. And in one school, I'm mentioning this because one school, so some of the parents that were, you know, aware of, you know, if you are selling unhealthy food, my kids will develop diseases. This is not good for them. And then the cafeteria stopped selling unhealthy food. And there was also this kind of manifestation and rebellion of the other parents, because they wanted to have the unhealthy food for their kids because their kids like it and they were used it too, and they wanted to have. So the school needed to bring it back to the cafeteria, the unhealthy food for the kids. So that's why my perception is that we need to have those kind of policies, but they need to come together with education and with alerts. So in Brazil, we have a good case for smoking, for cigarettes. So where we have a huge decrease in the prevalence of smokers in Brazil. And this was due to, you know, a very broad, not only campaign and policy, but everything integrated. So besides the campaigns and the policies against smoking, there was, you know, increasing costs of cigarettes. There was the banishment of propaganda of cigarettes in TVs or in different places in Brazil. And the boxes, the cigarette boxes, also they come with a horrible image of people, you know, who smoke and what are showing the consequence of smoking, a sentence also alerting of the risks of smoking. So several things that, you know, led to the outcomes we saw in Brazil. So I think the same for unhealthy food, unhealthy or sugary drinks, that we want to reduce dramatically their consumption. We need also to work together with, you know, in with informing, alerting the population, and also restricting the propaganda, and also increasing the prices, and obviously stop offering to kids, because obviously if you offer to kids, kids will be, you know, willing to try.
Well, you know, if you start early, you know, if you start early with these things, you can change behaviors in mature people by changing beliefs, right? If I believe that doing something is going to, you know, as a grown man, something's going to improve my health, I'm going to buy into it. Kids, it's different because their parents and their teachers control their environment. So we just make it impossible for them to get it. I mean, there were a number of schools in the United States that were being sponsored by the soft drink manufacturers. They were putting their machines in the school cafeteria and sponsoring their sports teams. And there were a number of schools that just said, no, we're not doing that. That's, you know, that's ridiculous. So it does require, and I guess it's going to lead me on to my next question, it does require a field change in the way we think. So, Mark, we've seen an ever-increasing prevalence of obesity globally. Pacific Island nations like Nauru, Cook Islands, Palau top the list. The United States comes in at 12th, the UK at 36th, and Brazil at 82nd in terms of, you know, global obesity rates. There, you know, of course, it's not maybe that populations are uber healthy. There may be other reasons that they're not obese, such as, you know, they're not wealthy. And as emerging nations become wealthier, how do we stop them falling into the unhealthy eating trap to go from hunger to obesity, which obviously impacts rates of diabetes and other chronic diseases?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a part of this question I have answered. So I think we need truly to be careful with food, the kind of food we are offering to the population, how we are offering, how visible we are making them. And sometimes unhealthy food is cheaper than healthy food. So the governments need to pay attention to that and to obviously give incentives to healthy food to be cheaper, to be available to different individuals. But talking about obesity, I think there are some different aspects that we should pay attention also is the planning of the cities sometimes does not favor exercising. So many cities that I visit, I ask, so where is a park? Where is, you know, you have areas that where people can exercise? And there is zero parks, zero places where people can exercise. So this is something also to be careful. But about Brazil, it is surprising to me to hear that it's in the 86 position.
82nd. But of course, 82nd. Again, Mark, it may not be because Brazilians are, you know, the healthiest, but, you know, there are parts of Brazil that do battle with poverty. We know this, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because in Brazil, one of our main challenges now is obesity and overweight. So last year a federal research showed that now 60% of the Brazilians are obese or overweight. So which is shocking. This is the first time we hear that in Brazil. And it doesn't stop growing, the number, you know, of people with obesity and overweight in Brazil, unfortunately. And this, so all the measures that have been taken so far haven't been effective on that. And so the goal of the minister, the current goal of the Minister of Health is to stop the growth, is not even to reduce, because it has been so difficult, so challenging, that it's at least to stop the growth on the prevalence of obesity and overweight in Brazil.
Yeah. So we've hinted at patient empowerment, and I know you're a big believer in this and your career speaks to that. Tell us about the various programs you've been involved with and how an educated patient is diabetes' worst enemy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously in different conditions, people will need, health conditions, people will need to self-manage, self-care, and develop skills for that. And in the case of diabetes, especially type 1 diabetes, there is a 24/7 condition where people need to check their blood sugar many times, inject insulin, and be careful with food and exercise. So think all the time on, you know, where they are going, what they are doing. It is, you know, it is key to start education, to develop the skills they will need from the very beginning, from the diagnosis. And for this, I think the different organizations, so some global, like the one where I belong to, IDF and other country organizations, also develop different programs and strategies for education. But some interesting things that, you know, the health professionals to know is that there are some basic curriculum to the skills that and the information, the knowledge that people need to receive and to develop from diagnosis. So ideally before leaving the hospital or the clinic when they receive the diagnosis, because they need to go home knowing how to, for example, measure and interpret the blood sugar or taking an action when there is a low blood sugar and what kind of action, or when there is a high blood sugar, and among others, obviously. And then what are the more advanced skills that need to be developed? But the thing is also, what we have noticed is that besides those skills for self-care, people with diabetes also sometimes are willing to develop skills to help others, to become leaders, to empower, to be empowered, not just to be, you know, to be healthy, but also to influence their community, to influence the society, and to make a difference, to make truly change makers. And for this reason, I have proposed, obviously, with a group of other people here in Brazil about 10 years ago, a leadership program for youth with diabetes or interest in diabetes. And this is a leadership program that happens every year. And we have been very successful assisting in developing leaders that are nowadays, you know, from health professionals to advocates participating in global platforms also, influencing policies and participating in discussions. So we are very proud of this kind of initiative that we developed in Brazil. And I should say that in parallel also we saw similar, and we collaborated with the development of those kinds of initiatives in neighbor countries like Uruguay, Paraguay, Chile, Ecuador, we were able to form a very prolific and strong network that collaborate in the development of this kind of program. And this year we published a framework that we developed from that. There is the empowerment letter. The idea is to identify where the individuals are in the beginning and where you want to, you know, them to be. So you can plan what you provide to individuals to empower them. And also you can monitor how they are going to different phases in this empowerment ladder.
And I noticed that you've done some innovative things such as educational board and digital games, right?
That's right, yeah. So we know that the education, the formal models of education, they are important, but also in case of diabetes that it's important to review things and to continue education and individuals in different age groups, you know, when they move from one age group to the other, they need to develop new skills and they need to acquire other knowledges, etc. It would be important to have different strategies. So that's why in partnership with different organizations and different individuals, many of them, they graduated in the leadership program that we developed. We built some materials, some tools for education, from comic books to applications that for kids or for even for adults, or picnics where they can share their experience and they can learn from each other, or diabetes camps. So initially we had diabetes camps for kids, which is, we know that diabetes camps for kids are extremely traditional and well succeed, and they really bring to the kids the independence and the confidence that they need to self-manage. But also we develop other programs and camps for adults that showed also to be very important for this group to be able to learn with their peers and to share their experiences.
Excellent. Yeah, you've really got to use sort of a multifunctional approach. And I know that you've played a big role in gender equality in healthcare, which has been a debate that has, you know, only fairly recently actually been getting the attention it deserves. This was a program empowering girls in, I believe, 18 different countries. Tell us about why do these inequities still exist and how your program's tackling that problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. I think this was, we were interested in this, I think, in parallel with the leadership programs, because we saw that there was a need to identify, so if the different genders were, you know, receiving the same attention, were being contemplated in the different programs equally, or if there was a difference. And in addition, obviously, to give voice to girls that are growing, and we know that there is still this inequity in the ways that girls are heard and boys, unfortunately, in many places. And so then we brought to Brazil, in partnership with Rise Up, an international organization in California, this program. There is the Girls' Voice. And we have been during this last year, I would say, developing this program in Brazil and empowering girls who now are implementing their programs. And not only in the health field, but also in gender equity, in violence against women, etc. But going back to the health field, what we have noticed also in one of the programs that we developed for diabetes and hypertension in primary health care was that 80% of the individuals going to the facilities, to the primary health facilities to attend, to participate in the program, were women. So men were not actually going to the primary health care. So then this was important because, you know, otherwise we would think that the program we were offering was benefiting the entire, you know, community. And this was not true. And then we needed to go after the reasons for not being, you know, kind of attended by men, the program, and to work on alternatives to attract men to the program, and also identifying that time was a problem, the time when it was offered was a problem, or the places where it was offered was a problem, to try also to diversify the times of the, you know, of the day or of the in the week or the places where it was offered to kind of make it more equitable to men and women.
Yeah, you know, this is, it's a recurring theme. Women are much better at looking after their health, and actually, I forget the exact number, but if you look at prostate decisions that men were making, if they have prostate cancer, more often than not, it's their wife, their girlfriend, who will make the decision for them. Men are just not as engaged as women in even in their own healthcare. And I know people do have to be creative about how they talk to men and where they talk to men. Astonishingly, we're different to ladies. And as the French say, vive la différence. So in 2017, the Intersectoral Forum to Fight Non-Communicable Diseases in Brazil that you founded connected the main stakeholders from various sectors to achieve sustainable goals from the United Nations to address these diseases. Tell us about that. It's a heck of an achievement.
Mm-hmm. So the Intersectoral Forum to Fight NCDs in Brazil was initially proposed by the Public Health Institute. I was working at the Public Health Institute in California at that time. And then we wanted to offer to some countries where we were, so also in India and in Africa, to offer a program that would give to the countries a platform to address their needs in terms of health in a way that would put together, would facilitate partnerships between the sectors, the private sector, public sector, and not-for-profit. So in Brazil, we researched, so we talked to different leaders in order to identify what was the priority and what model would be the best one to address, you know, the priority. And then what we identified, the priority was clearly non-communicable diseases, because they are kind of growing in terms of, you know, the leading cause for deaths in Brazil, and also that it needed to be a continuous initiative, not just, you know, one encounter to kind of equip individuals and then everyone going to their homes and hoping that they would do something. No, but a continuous platform where we could engage, which is what we do. So we identify the main players in the country from the different sectors. We bring them together twice a year, and then we discuss the priorities that are identified and by them. So they bring to us what they identify as priorities, and then we try to facilitate the partnerships in order to run programs or to propose policies for the country to address the main needs in terms of non-communicable diseases. And it has been very successful. That's why now we are going to our eighth edition of the encounter. But besides the encounter or convening or meeting that we do every 6 months, we also have a digital platform with many different channels. So we have our website, but also our Facebook page, LinkedIn, YouTube, etc., to facilitate this communication in between the participants, and also our monthly newsletter, where one can announce opportunities that can be, you know, kind of interesting to other participants of this initiative.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's become apparent during this terrible global pandemic is that we are one species, we are one people, and we do need to share best learnings, best approaches, and also what doesn't work so that our fellow humans around the planet can have the best possible lives. And along those lines, what's your biggest regret in the world of diabetes research, education, anything really that's impacted the disease negatively? Is it the growth of sugary drinks? What would it be?
I think it is. So as you know, this year is important for the diabetes community because it's the 100 years of the insulin discovery. And so yeah. I think one of the biggest regrets is that many people with diabetes, living with diabetes in the world, still do not have access to insulin or to, you know, the medicines or to test strips that they need to live, healthy. And this is very serious. I think most people do not have the dimension, do not understand how serious it is that every month we unfortunately hear of children dying because they did not have access to insulin. So this is very dramatic and regretful.
Well, as the world shrinks, hopefully we can deal with some of these inequities, because as you say, it's tragic. Mark, if you were in charge of diabetes education for the entire world, and every political leader, every minister of health, and diabetic patient and carer were listening, what three things would you tell them all?
So I think I would alert once again that treating diabetes is much cheaper than treating the complications. And it is unfair to do not provide the medicines and the care that people need and wait for the complications to develop and then spend much more in we know there are a terrible situation where the entire community is impacted by an individual that became blind or lost their legs or had a heart attack that could be prevented. So please provide care and medicines to individuals living with diabetes and also other non-communicable diseases, obviously. In addition, I would say that there are different organizations in some global and some in different countries that can help with diabetes education. And this is also critical because many healthcare professionals, they know almost nothing about diabetes. So they would be willing to help and to do their best, but they don't have information. They don't know what to do. So it is important to look for those organizations, partner with them, and use their, sometimes resources and or help to educate healthcare professionals and also to educate educators, because obviously individuals with diabetes need to develop also skills to self-care, which is fundamental, I think. And another and the last one that I need to emphasize is regarding research. We saw that during this pandemic, obviously most of the research were directed to the pandemic, to developing the vaccine, and it makes sense. But we should not stop researching on diabetes cure, diabetes treatment. Otherwise, it will be hard to evolve in this condition also.
Well, I wish you were in charge of diabetes education for the whole world. I think we'd be better off if you had that responsibility. Dr. Mark Barone, thank you very, very, very much for coming on the podcast today and sharing your wisdom with us. Keep up the good fight. You're doing great work.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, that's it for today. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please tell your friends and colleagues to join us. Tick the boxes on social media and listen in next Friday for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sackler.